We got some work to do today.
Whoa, Eric sneaking in under the wire. Sneaking in. Proverbs 25:28. Let's start there. And then we're going to Exodus, we're going to Daniel, we're going to Luke. Where else are we going? I got 3 pages of notes today. That never happens. Yeah. All kinds of stuff. 25:28. Last verse. Have we talked about this one yet? You guys have like shiny notes in this. I say it, and then this is the type of year where I'm like, yeah.
We haven't gone through that verse yet.
Good. Okay. What comes to mind when I say, sorry, I'm terrible with, I'm trying to think through recent stuff like that's hitting our news media right now. Anybody of you remember Ricky Williams, football player for the Miami Dolphins a couple years ago? Played, had a great career, and then decided he was just going to quit because he wanted to go smoke pot, right? And that was literally, he's like, no, I want to smoke pot, and I'm not going to stop smoking pot, and that's what I'm going to do. And tried to come back and couldn't. He just literally, his whole career floundered because he did not have control over that area of his life. You think through Bill Clinton, maybe when he was in office, you think about the stain that was on him based on his inability to control his body in a sexual way, right? There were numerous women that there were allegations at the time that now have been proven to some degree, right? And now he's cleaning up his image a bit, doing some philanthropic work and such. But as you think about the legacy that he has as a president, that's stained him, right? That is a memory for him that he sticks with the rest of his life. Who else can you guys think of that's in the news that literally is tanking their lives because of a inability to control their body, be it emotional, anger, whatever? Who's hitting now?
Bill Cosby.
Bill Cosby's a great one. That's a great, right?
Johnny Manziel.
Manziel, right, who's now in rehab and out of rehab, and literally that's a great one, right? Who has a great football career ahead of him if he could just stop partying with his friends on the weekends. Bill Cosby, who we find out has had years, decades, if you will, of impropriety with women, and now is coming out. And he was the shining, you know, bright example of the wholesome father figure, right, in the 80s. I grew up watching that, and it's a farce, and obviously it's later. But you get the idea, okay? 25:28 is talking about this concept, like a city that is broken into without walls. What is a city in this day and age without walls? It's vulnerable. It's a turtle on its back, okay? It doesn't matter how magnificent it is. It's just a matter of time before it's going to be destroyed and before it's going to be overtaken by an enemy. It's simply a matter of when, not if. Like a city that is broken into without walls is a man who has no control over his spirit. Or a woman, right? Either would be appropriate there. Who has no control over his ruach, his spirit, his lower passions, if you will. It's just a matter of time before there is a wall that they are going to hit. It's 60 miles an hour and completely implode or explode their lives, right? You guys remember reading in high school like I did the Iliad and the Odyssey? I always forget the main character in there, that as they were sailing past the sirens, he wanted to hear the call of the sirens, but recognized that, is it Ulysses?
Odysseus.
I always call him Ulysses. Where is Ulysses? Is he in the other story?
That's Grant's
Civil War. Totally wrong. Like, not even in the same genre. I didn't even read that book. You guys know your stuff.
In our brother, the guy's name is Ulysses.
Different.
You
make no comments all year about Proverbs, and you know your English lit marvelously well. Okay, got it. All right, I haven't seen O Brother War. Well, I did, but it wasn't around when I grew up reading in English. That was later. That's an allegory of...
Yes.
Man, I'm thick-headed. See, you guys are brilliant. Who knew? Sneaky brilliant. Anyway, Odysseus realized that he had no control, just like all the other men that had sailed by these sirens, and though he understood... logically, not to run his ship into the rocks, he understood that he could not not do that, right? So he had his crewmen strap him to the mast of the ship. They all put wax in their ears, and he made a deal with them saying, I don't care what I tell you or how loud I scream, do not remove me from this mast. And he ended up sailing through and hearing the call of the sirens without wrecking his life in the process, right? He's one of the few that we see that had that understanding. Okay, this is what this proverb is talking about, that as men and women, if we do not have the ability to control our lower passions, to know ultimately what our itches are that desire to get scratched, and if we can't demonstrate self-control over those, that ultimately is the end result of all of us. We're like a city without walls, okay? As I sit here and talk about that idea, you're full aware of what your itches are, if you will. I'm full aware of what mine are. If my life is going to end up on the rocks one day on the shores, I know what the issues more than likely will be, all right? You're not going to find me, you know, hammered in a bar one day. Each of us have certain tendencies and leanings in life. We need to be aware of those. We need to be honest with those. And we need to not be this example of 25, 28 of someone who cannot control their passions, all right? Unless we have a story like a Johnny Manziel or Ricky Williams or Bill Clinton or what have you. So there you go, all right? So as you think through your own life, make sure that you are aware and actively dealing with the passion areas of your life, all right? So we all got them, and we need to deal with them appropriately, all right? Cool? All right. Exodus. We are about halfway through our plagues, right? We saw that yesterday. Let's see if I can throw our handy-dandy chart up here for you guys. All right, so we've seen that, right? So on the bottom left-hand corner, you can kind of see the plagues that we've been dealing with so far. First with the Nile turning to blood, we saw the frogs come in after that. The little bugs in the third plague, I should say, number three. And then the big bugs, the flies after that. And then we're about to deal with livestock, all right? And we're dealing with, again, this theme of redemption. Chapters 1 through 11, God is dealing with the subjectivity of his people. He's kind of putting the screws on them, making it hard. It's been hard for 400 years, and now they're about to get released. And God is kind of slowly, methodically working his way through dealing with Egypt and dealing with Israel as well. All right, so somebody pray for us, and we will dive back into chapter 8 with the end of these plagues and kind of finish those up with the Passover this morning. So who wants to pray? So many volunteers. Thank you. Thank you. All right. So we started in the last one of chapter 8, verse 20, rather. I'll get all my words together at some point this morning. And rolling through kind of the flies and the issues with that. And then we saw Pharaoh begin to make some concessions with Moses, offering him now four compromises. We see the first one in 8:25. You can go sacrifice, but you got to stay within the land. Then Moses says no to that. 8:28, he says, man, I'll let you go, but you could just not go very far away. How about that? And Moses says, no, that's not going to happen either. Okay, we'll see the next one's coming in chapter 10. Those will be 3 and 4, the compromises that are coming then. But before we see Pharaoh offer those, we got a couple more plagues coming. Okay, Moses, chapter 8, verse 29, instructs Pharaoh to not be deceitful with him anymore, to be honest. At the end of verse 29, Moses went out, made supplication for Pharaoh. Moses asked in verse 31 for the swarms of insects to be removed, and God does. But 32, as is the pattern, Pharaoh hardened his heart this time also, and he did not let the people go. So we're seeing obviously this continual theme with Pharaoh. He hardens his own heart. God hardens his heart. His heart was hardened. Regardless of the process of it, his heart has continued to be hardened. And we're seeing that God is doing something behind the scenes to demonstrate who he is, to execute judgment against the Egyptian gods. There's a number of factors that are happening, but ultimately God's glory is at stake, and God is going to demonstrate that glory. Okay, so chapter 9, verse 1, let's pick up there, and let's watch now the fifth plague of the livestock.
Plague upon your livestock that are in the field, the horses, the donkeys, the camels, the
All right, so everything that you've got livestock-wise that is your source of food and income is going to die. Okay, however, verse 4, keep reading.
But the Lord will make a distinction between the livestock of Israel herds and the flocks. But the Lord will make and the livestock of Egypt, so that nothing of all that belongs to the people of Israel shall die.
So God's done this now a second time, distinguishing between who he's going to punish and who he's not. Egypt is going to get the wrath. Israel will not. The Lord set a definite time, saying, tomorrow this thing is going to happen. Verse 6, all the livestock of Egypt died. But some of the livestock of the sons of Israel, not one died. So God brings this execution. You can imagine looking out over a land that deals with, this is their primary means. I mean, can you imagine waking up on a farm and seeing thousands of head of cattle dead? That had to be a pretty eye-opening experience, pretty significant, and God, again, is executing these judgments, saying, I'm in charge, and I'm the one that's taking care of this. Yep.
Would the cattle have still been in Goshen with the... And then would it still have been the Hebrews watching over them?
It seems like it. That's still the case. How much of that is true now that there's a new Pharaoh who doesn't know Joseph? A lot's changed, so I'm sure there's some distinction. We don't get news on that. I would imagine that's changed a bit, given the hostile relationships between the two. And we're going to see some of the cattle are still around. They're going to get dealt with more here in a bit. It looks like the vast majority of Egypt's cattle die, and somehow there's a distinction between the two. Okay, so now we're going to deal with, we got the livestock dead. Now we're going to deal with disease coming on man. Okay, verse 8, Lord says to Moses, take soot from a kiln, okay, your cooking area. Let Moses throw it in the sky toward the side of Pharaoh in verse 8. It will, in verse 9, become fine dust over the land of Egypt and will become boils, breaking out as sores on man and beast throughout all of Egypt. So we're going to give everybody nasty, pussy sores and ugh, right? And Moses is going to do this by throwing soot from a kiln in the air. Verse 10, they took it. Moses threw it toward the sky and it became boils, breaking out with sores on man and beast. So everything that's alive, livestock-wise, man that is there, has boils all over them, okay? The magicians, this is funny, verse 11, could not stand before Moses because of the boils, and the boils were on the magicians as well as on all the Egyptians. So they are unable to even come out and try to replicate and make more boils, as if that would have been helpful, right? They're in bed itching their scratchy, you know, nasty boils. So just you can see the discomfort. The God is just working them over systematically, okay? So we lost now all the livestock. Now we got boils. Verse 13, now we're going to see hail. So we're going to now destroy all of your crops. And what crops we don't get with the hail, we're going to get with another plague that's coming. So God sends now hail in verse 13 and following. We're going to destroy everything. And look at verse 16. God says something to Pharaoh here that's pretty fascinating through the mouth of Moses. 9:16. So what does that tell you about why God is doing what he's doing? My text says, I have allowed you to remain. Like I'm executing these judgments and I'm not done. I'm going to make you stay here, Pharaoh, until the end, and you're going to see everything. According to verse 16, what is God doing? We just knew so much about English just a minute ago, and now it's like, in order to show you my power, my glory, I am demonstrating before you who I am. There's not a lot of times in history where God says, hey, time out, watch me. I'm about to do something crazy big and you're going to stand by and see it. No one's going to wonder, is that a miracle? Did that, you know, like, this is insane. You see it here. You're going to see it with the parting of the Red Sea. We see it with the resurrection of Christ. But as you think through in the grand scheme of history, God literally putting his display of power before all of us is not very frequent. And these guys are systematically watching all of their gods be disposed of by Yahweh as they're watching this crazy ability of our God to work. Okay, so he's demonstrating that against Pharaoh. He's watching him. Verse 19, watch now what happens. So you got an option. You want to cover them up, cover them up. If you don't, that's fine. Okay, so some did, verse 21. Some did, 21, but those who had no regard for the word of the Lord left their servants and the livestock in the field. So they said, what the heck? We don't care, right? All these other plagues, they're God's probably just getting lucky. This probably won't really happen, right? 21, they found out the hard way. Okay, 22, God says to Moses, stretch out your hands toward the sky. Hail may fall upon man and on beast and every plant of the field. So we've got not just livestock being killed in this process, but probably servants that are out in the field, the non-Israelites. Is that my phone? Hopefully not. That are dying kind of in the midst of this. So it is a bad, bad day. Moses stretched out his staff. In 23, hail comes and the Lord rained hail on the land of Egypt. Okay, an odd phenomenon that you would see, obviously not normal in this area. It's kind of like getting hail in Fresno. It's like, huh, what is that stuff falling from the sky? Similar to rain that we don't understand either. So all of it. Okay, so they are getting pounded at this point. Verse 26, only in the land of Goshen, where the sons of Israel were, was there no hail. So God protects Goshen and their land once again. Okay, 27 now, here comes the repentance of Pharaoh. Read that. I haven't sinned yet, but this time I think I have. Thanks, Pharaoh.
Plead with the Lord, for there has been enough of God's thunder and hail. I will let you go, and you shall stay no longer. Moses said to him, as soon as I have gone out of the city, I will stretch out my hands to the Lord. The thunder will cease, and there will be no more hail, so that you may know that the earth is the Lord's. But as for you and your servants, I know that you do not yet fear the Lord.
How about that? Like, I know you're blowing smoke, Pharaoh, right? And sure enough, verse 34, when Pharaoh saw that the rain and the hail and the thunder had ceased, he sinned again and hardened his heart, he and his servants. Can you imagine as a leader watching your nation be destroyed from right in front of you and having a complete and utter inability to do anything about it, and everything is dying, right? Your crops are gone, your people started to die, your livestock's dead, you have boils on your body, your water source has been jacked with and now it's back, but you are completely and utterly useless to help, right? That has got to be a pretty haunting thing. And he is just angry and prideful and hard-hearted to the end of this entire process, okay? Now, chapter 10, whatever the hail did not destroy, now God's going to bring locusts, and they're going to eat whatever else is remaining on the vines and trees and what have you at this point. And again, if you've seen locusts move through, they destroy everything. They are God's, I don't know what you call them, but man, they can take down airplanes if the swarm is big enough, and they literally will blacken the sky as a result of their size and their mass. So God's now going to send this eighth plague with the locusts in chapter 10. Verse 5, it says, they will cover the surface of the land, that no one shall be able to see the land. They shall also eat and rest on what has escaped. Whatever is left from your hail, they shall at every tree which sprouts out from the field, they're going to eat everything. Houses will be filled with your servants. It's going to be basically a very, very bad day. And in verse 7, Pharaoh's servants said to him, how long will this man be a snare to us? Let the men go. These are Pharaoh's advisors speaking to him, that they may go serve their God. Do you not yet realize that Egypt is destroyed? And you still, Pharaoh, are not softening and allowing Moses to lead his people out of there. So at this point on plague 8, they realize it's done. Israel, or Egypt rather, is completely destroyed, and yet Pharaoh still is hardening his heart. Okay. Now in the midst of that, now that we've got no crop, now we have a famine, right? All the food is gone, livestock's gone for Egypt. Moses now has the audacity to say in verse 9 and 10, read that.
Moses said, we will go with our young and our old. We will go with our sons and daughters and with our flocks and herds, for we must hold a feast to the Lord.
Hold a what? A feast. By the way, what condition are you in right now, Egypt? You're in a famine, right? But God protected us, right? We have crops. We didn't get hail. We didn't get all of our livestock killed. God made a distinction. We have food. We're good. And we're going to have a buffet, okay? That's what we're going to do. So it's a little bit, it's like, hey, Pharaoh, this is what you chose, man. If that's what you want, knock yourself out, okay? We're going to hold a feast. You're going to let us go. And now Pharaoh says, okay, here's compromise number 3. You didn't like my first two offers? How about this in verse 11?
No. Go, the men among you, and serve the Lord, for that is what you are asking. And they were driven out from Pharaoh's presence.
So what now does Pharaoh offer him in verse 11? You can go, but who can go? Just the dudes. Now, why would you offer that as Pharaoh? What does he know if you just leave the men and the women and children behind? What are they going to do? they're going to come back, right? They're guaranteed to come back. So he's not going to lose his servants and his slaves to do the work of his hand. So he knows that's a great offer, okay? Moses says, uh-uh. Okay, stretch out your hand over the locusts that they may come up out of the land of Egypt and every plant of the land and even the hail that is left. So he's again asking for this to stop. Okay, this is what the Lord speaking to Moses now to relent. They covered in verse 15 the entire surface of the whole land, so the land was darkened, and they ate every plant in verse 15. Nothing green was left on tree or plant or field throughout all the land of Egypt. I mean, we have total and complete destruction of food source, first from the hail, now the locust. So it is crazy. Verse 16, Pharaoh hurriedly called and said to Moses and Aaron, I've sinned against the Lord the God, right? We've heard this before. It's like, you know, just put him on repeat, right? He confesses, verse 17, therefore, please forgive my sin this once and make supplication to the Lord. Ask God to, you know, relent. God does. Okay, he shifted the wind in verse 19 to remove the locust. But in verse 20, the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the sons of Israel go. So same. Okay, ninth plague now. This is the last one before we get to the death of the firstborn. We're now going to see darkness. Okay, as we're upping the ante against the gods that they're dealing with, this would have been against Ra, the sun god, R-A or R-E, I'm not quite sure how you spell it, but the idea is this is the god of the sun. So when you're bringing complete darkness over a land in the middle of the day, you are basically saying to their god, bring it. What do you have? Okay, so this is a challenge to Ra, the sun god. Okay, pick up in verse 21.
Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward heaven, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt. Darkness to be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand toward heaven, and there was pitch darkness in all the land of Egypt 3 days.
Can you imagine that? I mean, just that's creepy. 3 days of just the sun never came up. Like, oh, gosh. Like, yeah, that's a big deal. You figure out how God cosmologically did that, but that's gnarly, okay? Verse 24, Pharaoh says to Moses, okay, here's compromise number four. Go serve the Lord. Only let your flocks and your herds be detained. Even your little ones can go with you. So now what's the offer? You can go. Everybody, the people can go, but what has to stay?
Your stuff.
Your stuff, right? Moses is going to say, no. You must let us, in verse 25, have sacrifices and burnt offerings that we may sacrifice them to the Lord our God. God requires sacrifice from us. We've got to take all these things. We don't want to dishonor our God, as you have. So in 26, Moses says, not a hoof will be left behind. Thank you. We're going to take everything. So Moses, to the last offering of compromise, says no to Pharaoh, and ultimately says in verse 27, the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. He was not willing to let them go. Pharaoh says to him in verse 28, get away from me. Beware. Do not see my face again. For in the day that I see your face, you shall die. And Moses said, you are right. I shall never see your face again. It's about to get bad. Okay. Last plague now in chapter 11. This is ugly. Okay. Pick up 11 verse 1.
Now the Lord said to Moses, one more plague I will bring on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will surely drive you out. Speak now to the hearing of the people that each man ask from his neighbor and each woman from her neighbor for articles of silver and articles of gold.
All right, so this is where they're going to begin to take and plunder literally the Egyptians. Okay, so we'll see that kind of at the end of chapter 12. Verse 4, Moses said this is what's going to happen. Pick up there.
Thus says the Lord, about midnight I am going out into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die. From the firstborn of the Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the millstones, all the firstborn of the cattle as well.
So any firstborn, man or beast, Egypt or Israel, it doesn't matter. They are all going to die. Okay, that is a pretty harsh punishment. And for whatever reason, God does not give Israel a distinction. He will here in chapter 12 as to how to do that. But he says, if you don't demonstrate by faith what I'm going to show you in chapter 12, your kids are going to die. I don't care if they're Egyptian or if they're Israeli. They're all ultimately going to die, Hebrew or not. Okay? Verse 6, keep going.
Moreover, there shall be a great cry in all the land of Egypt, such as there has not been before, and
such as shall never be again. But against any of the sons of Israel, a dog shall not even bark, whether against man or beast, that you may understand how the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel.
Okay, so God's saying, if they will demonstrate again in chapter 12 this act of faith by how he says to be protected, it's going to be clear that God is executing judgments on Egypt and not on Israel because of their faith and their ability to follow God. So it is about to be ugly. And this is a horrible chapter. If you guys have seen The Prince of Egypt, it's old and dated now. But this scene, as chapter 12, the Spirit of the Lord comes in and takes the firstborn lives, is just creepy. Just to hear breathing, you know, and they play it in the background, and all of a sudden you hear, and the breath is like gone from a kid while they're sleeping. It's just, oh, and to wake up and to think the outcry and the pain that would have been there for parents. We're talking about millions at this point with Egypt, and that's an awful, awful thing, okay? Now, chapter 12, verse 1, here is God's plan to cover Israel, the Hebrews, from the death of the firstborn. Here's what they must do. Chapter 12, verse 1, pick up there.
Now the Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month shall be the beginning of months for you. It is to be the first month of the year to you.
All right, now what month are we in? Anybody got a note in their Bible as to what month they're talking about?
Abib,
yeah, Abib, okay, literally means the ear, okay? It's the time of the year when the corn is in the ear, okay? So it's about ready to be harvested. It's March or April in our calendar, okay? And God says, this is going to be your January 1st, okay? It's not actually in January, but in their calendar, that's the significance of it. This is their religious new year. So the things that we do, like on our new year to start over and kind of some of those types of things, this is going to be the beginning of months for them, okay? This is Passover, obviously, about what's about to occur. We're going to read this for the first time, and God is kind of commemorating what's about to occur here, okay? So we're in, again, March, April, spring season, as the ear is in, the corn is in the ear, okay, and ready to come out, which is what Abib means. It's called Nisan in the Babylonian deal, and that's what it's referred to moving forward, okay? So it's the month of Nisan in a Hebrew calendar, okay? That's the first month, okay? Verse 3 now, here comes the process.
Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, they are each one to take a lamb for themselves according to their father's households, a lamb for each household. Now if the household is too small for a lamb, then he and his neighbor nearest to his house to take one according to the number of persons in them. According to what each man should eat, you are to divide the lamb.
All right, so you're going to get a lamb for every household, okay? So that can be probably 10 to 20 people can share a lamb. So if your household's too small, grab your neighbor's house, right? You're going to have a potluck together, and you're eating lamb, okay? The 10th of the month, right? So the 10th of what month? Nisan, okay? This is known as Lamb Selection Day. This is the day you go pick out your lamb, okay? The 10th of Nisan was Lamb Selection Day, and we get a description of what said lamb needed to look like in verse 5. Now remember, in Israel, they don't think like we think. They think in terms of word pictures and imagery and things of that nature. We think as Americans in our Western upbringing, in our Western culture, with bullet points, abstract things, ideas, stuff like that, God is showing them pictures. And you guys understand this. The picture that they're about to see represents something bigger than just a lamb and blood and eating and that sort of thing, right? So verse 5, think through this with Hebrew eyes and what God is communicating for them. Verse 5, read that.
Your lamb shall be an unblemished male, a year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats.
All right, so talk to me about said lamb. Why is that description significant?
Unblemished.
Okay, it's unblemished, so you have a perfect, a spotless lamb, okay? Male or female?
Male.
Okay, now are female lambs ever offered, or female goats or sheep, later in the Levitical law?
Yeah,
absolutely. There's nothing wrong with a female sacrifice in certain sacrifices, but not in this one. It has to be a what? Unblemished male lamb, okay? And that blood of that lamb is going to ultimately do what? It's going to save them. It's going to atone for them. You guys know the picture of what we're about to read, right? So obviously looking fast forward in our sense and understanding Christ and the significance of the sacrifice, this is obviously going to be a really big deal for us, and the significance and the picture that is. Christ is our Passover lamb. His blood was shed, the perfect male sacrifice on our behalf is going to be this picture. Okay, so we see that. They don't see that yet, but they're seeing pictures of what their Messiah is supposed to be, right? This is all pointing towards their Mashiach, okay, in Hebrew, their Messiah, okay? Now, Fluffy comes home with you on the 10th of Nisan and stays at your house until verse 6.
You shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel is to kill it at twilight.
All right, so how long does Fluffy live in your house until you die? Until it dies, rather. Yeah, 10th to the 14th, right? So 5 days, right? 10th, 11, 12, 13, 14. Okay, so 5 days Fluffy lives in your house, okay? I have three girls at home, four with my wife, right? And now we got Fluffy in our backyard. And Fluffy's hanging out with us. Fluffy just got named, right? Fluffy's called Fluffy now. Why would God make you live with Fluffy for 5 days? To be attached, right? What do you think my kids are telling me as I'm taking Fluffy to the priest to go get killed? No, Daddy, no, Daddy. You know, like, don't kill Fluffy. We love Fluffy, right? That's the idea. You're getting attached to the lamb. There's personal investment in it. You love it. It lives with you. It hangs out in your backyard. That's the idea. In the midst of this, in the future, as we get past this first Passover, Israel's going to be commanded to commemorate this every year. Moses is going to say, this is a yearly mandatory feast and festival. You're going to do this forever, right? So that process would have resulted in all males were required to come to Israel, to Jerusalem in the future with the temple that we'll talk about later and celebrate this. So regardless of where you live, this was mandatory road trip. You came in and you celebrated Passover as a male for sure, and more than likely you would have brought your family if you had the means to do that. And there would be this gigantic party where everybody's picking out a lamb, everybody's having, you know, their lambs over, and then this process would be significant, okay? So you take the lamb, verse 7, watch what you're going to do with it after you kill it.
Moreover, they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses in which they eat it. They shall eat the flesh that same night, roasted with fire, and they shall eat it with the unleavened bread and bitter herbs.
All right, so the picture is this. You would take that. It wasn't your job to kill the lamb. That was part of the it had to be done through the priesthood that is going to be established later. So in the future, here's what would happen. You would take Fluffy to the temple, and there would be priests on duty that whose job it was to kill the lamb, and you would be a part of that. So you and maybe even your son, who was of age, would be allowed to do this, but you would take Fluffy, and you'd go down there, and you would take a knife, and you would literally stand over Fluffy with its head here, and you would take a knife, and you would slit the knife, this sheep's throat, the lamb's throat, with that knife. In a basin that would have been underneath his throat, they would catch the blood, the priest would. Then when they'd take that blood to the altar, pour it on the altar, then they would skin the lamb, they would put it on a, you know, like a spigot, and then roast it and that sort of thing. So it was a whole process, and everyone got to see it. The entire family would go there to watch this. And as literally hundreds of thousands of lambs are being killed on this day, okay, this would have been a big deal. The sounds, the smells, and everything is a part of this whole experience. So that's the idea of what's happening, okay? Yep.
What's the significance of doing it at twilight?
Based on their days and just when it happens, there were two sacrifices every day in the temple that we'll look to, okay? One's at 9 and one's at 3, okay? 9 in the morning and 3 in the afternoon. So you're going to kill the lamb at twilight, which is the end of one day and the beginning of the next in their timetable. So it's dinner time. So that's the idea. I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah. It literally means between evenings. So it's at sundown is kind of when this is happening. So, but yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. Okay. But it's a new day.
When they say firstborn, do they mean all firstborn or firstborn that haven't received their blessing?
All.
So
all
like
firstborn.
Like adults that have had children.
I think at this point it would have been those without kids. So it's firstborn of the kids that are currently in your household. So if you're a dad, I'm a firstborn. It wouldn't have been me, it would have been my kids.
Yeah.
So they haven't had kids yet, I guess is probably the way to say it. So okay. So that's the picture. Okay. And with that, in verse 8, you're gonna eat the flesh that night, roasted with fire. You're gonna eat it with unleavened bread. Okay. Why unleavened bread? What's leaven a picture of in the scriptures? sin. Okay, and we're going to see the following festival after that. And you can see it up there on the chart. It goes from Passover, and then unleavened bread is next. That's the very next day they begin this process of unleavened bread. Why unleavened bread as well? What's the purpose of not having to wait for leaven? What does leaven do to bread? Rise. Causes it to rise, which takes time. So unleavened bread you can make quickly, okay? They're getting ready to leave Egypt in a hurry, okay? So you're going to eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. Why bitter herbs? What would that remind the Israelis of, the Hebrews of, for eternity? Every year when they would do this, why would God remind them with a bitter taste? Yeah, their 400 years in slavery has been bitter. And again, you see this experience. This is the Seder Supper, the Passover Seder that will continue to exist. And they are called on every year to remember this. Remember what bondage felt like and how awful it was to be enslaved to a group of people. And God's kind of setting the tone as to how they're going to do that. Okay, unleavened bread, bitter herbs. Verse 9, do not eat any of it raw or boiled with it water, but rather roasted with fire, both its head and its legs, along with its entrails. Okay, you're going to eat all of it. Okay, you shall not leave any of it until morning. Don't put any of it in Tupperware. You're going to eat it that night. Okay, you shall eat it in this manner. Verse 11, this is fascinating. Read that.
You shall eat it in this manner, with your loins girded, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. And you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover.
What is that description? Okay, loins girded, sandals on your feet, staff in your hand, in haste. You're ready to go. Okay, this is fast food. Okay, this isn't take your shoes off, put your feet on the coffee table, and linger and have a glass of wine. This is get ready to go. We're eating and we're out of here. Okay, so again, the picture of what God's trying to show them. For I will go through, verse 12, read that. This is fascinating again as to why God is doing what he's doing, and he says it very clearly here.
For I will go through the land of Egypt on that night and strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments.
Against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. You see that? God has been in the ring with every one of their gods, and now he's in round 10, and he's going to take down Ra, and he's going to take down Pharaoh, who thinks he is the incarnation of a god. He is the highest god in Egypt and in the world. So he is communicating, no, I'm God, and I am going to execute my judgments against all their gods. So, fascinating picture of what God's doing. Keep going there in 13.
The blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you live, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and no plague will befall you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt.
All right, so you guys got the picture. So you've got literally a doorpost, right? You've got your door, and they would take the blood and put it here, here, and here. And as God passed over them, he would see the blood on their lintels and on their doorposts and pass over that home, because the blood of the lamb has covered them, has atoned for them, is the picture, okay? So God would see that and move to the next house, okay? So that's kind of the imagery that God is going to see from his perspective. It's the blood of the lamb that saves him, okay? Verse 14, this day shall be a memorial for you, and for you to celebrate it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You are to celebrate it as a permanent ordinance. God is saying, this is a really, really big deal. And we're going to see today in Israel, they still do this. They shut down. They do all this process. They get family over. I mean, we're talking 4,000 plus years later-ish, a little less than 4,000. This still happens today. So they take this obviously very, very seriously. Okay. Then again, we saw in verse 15, 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. So Passover starts on the 14th. The very next day, unleavened bread starts for 7 days. So this feast is kind of intertwined in there, along with, you see on the chart up here on the bottom right, first fruits is on the 16th of Nisan. So there are three feasts of their seven that are all kind of crammed together, okay? So the 16th of Nisan would have been first fruits, which is when you celebrated a portion of the harvest, okay? So this is a big season in terms of Hebrew history and what's going on, okay? But I just want you guys to see the imagery of what's happening, what God's trying to communicate. It's not just for the people that are there. It's for all the folks that are going to come after them and to remember what God is doing in this event, okay? So that's the picture. We get more of the... the description in 21 and following of what it's going to look like and the ordinances and that sort of thing. Most of it we've kind of already seen. Okay, now in verse 29, here comes the actual event that night. Okay, so they have slain their lambs. If they've been obedient Israelites, they have put the blood on their doorpost. And in 29, it's now midnight. That night, watch what God does. How about that? I mean, every Egyptian house, somebody dies. And that's horrific. I mean, you can imagine the pain and the outcry, and that's horrible. Just the, you see what they're going through, but they're having to deal with the wrath of their king, their Pharaoh who will not repent, and they're having to live in the backwash of that. Many there probably felt the same as Pharaoh did. The heck with you. There were many, obviously, that didn't feel that way. They brought their cattle in because they believed what God was doing, and they are suffering because of the poor leadership, ultimately, of their ruler.
Do you think those children went to hell?
If they didn't believe in God, yes. Pharaoh arose that night, not a single child that wasn't dead. What does that remind you of, by the way, in verse 30? As you think through the Abrahamic covenant, land, seed, and blessing, what did God promise to the nations that blessed Israel, that took care of Israel? What would they be to all them around them? All, what would Israel be to them? A blessing, right? What if they didn't? What would they get? A curse. See also a nation that said, we're going to enslave Israel, we're going to put them in bondage, and they're receiving exactly what God said in Genesis chapter 12. They're receiving the curse of being anti God's nation. So, hard truth, okay? He called Moses and Aaron that night, verse 31, and says, now it's time, get out. You and your sons go and worship the Lord as I have said. Verse 32, take your flocks, your herds, as I have said, and bless me also. Verse 33, the Egyptians urged the people to send them out of the land in haste, and they said, we shall all be dead. The people took their dough before it was leavened with their kneading bowls bound up and the clothes on their shoulder. Literally, they're taking their stuff out of the oven before it's done cooking, right? And leaving in haste. So the picture that God gives them is you're going to go and you're going to go now. This is the middle of the night, right? Israel, verse 35, did it just as God had commanded them through the word, obviously, of Moses. And they had requested from the Egyptians at the end of verse 35, silver, gold, clothing. The Lord had given them in verse 36, favor in the sight of the Egyptians so that they let them have their request. Thus, they plundered the Egyptians. They don't lift a finger in the battle, and they leave having completely destroyed this nation. There's no food supply. Half the, I don't know if it's half, but every male in a household is dead. They're leaving as if they won a war, and they did, and God won it for them. So hard, hard truths in here, but that is the word picture kind of what's happening. All right, you guys tracking with me? So this is Passover. Every year, Jews are commanded to celebrate this, and it is a commemoration of their bondage in Israel, their celebration of God getting them out. In verse 37 and following, we're now going to take kind of a different path. This is kind of where this piece ends, and kind of now Israel's discipleship is going to begin. We're going to pause there for a second, and I want to show you guys something else in Daniel and in Luke that are going to tie into this, okay? So, but that's the picture. You guys all get kind of an idea of Passover. Any questions about that before we kind of move on? Probably, that's probably a piece of it. Yeah, you're about to go on a road trip and you need some, pack your knapsack. Yeah, Stephen. Yeah. We talked about that a little bit yesterday, right? Remember the promises in Exodus chapter 6 where God says, I will deliver you, free you, redeem you, and take you to be my own. Those promises are what the Passover revolved around, and each one of those was commemorated with a glass of wine. Or a cup of wine. So, make sense? So, in the future, that's what they're going to do to celebrate that. We don't see that here specifically. So I don't know if that's tradition or other places in Scripture where we see it, but that's how the Seder would have been done. So, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if I can point to a verse that says that, but that's how they would have done that. I don't think that means each individual pound 4 glasses of wine. It means each glass symbolizes something. Take a sip, okay? So that's not a... Everybody's not drinking a bottle and half a wine or whatever it would be, right? So, like, man, yes, that's a great party we will got, right? And that's not what God's saying. So each glass represented something. It wasn't for one person to drink all of it, if you will.
It's also a different wine, though, right? Like it's usually like a watered down wine.
No, it's wine. In fact, we were at not Passover, but when we were in Israel with Ronan and our crew, they had, just like us, good wine and bad wine. And they called the stuff that they would often drink over Passover called hammer wine, because it would get you hammered. So they had these little bottles that sometimes if you were out or you were with the military and had to celebrate Passover and you were away from home, they would give them this little, like, I don't know, like nasty bottles of wine. And that was they called it hammer wine. So you always woke up with a headache, Ronan said. So anyway, but yeah, it's the real deal, apparently. So I don't know what to compare it to here, but it ain't two buck chuck.
So the people took their dough before it was leavened. Was that after is it a week of eating unleavened bread?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What does that mean there? Was this after that 1 week?
I think the idea is before it had risen or would have had time to rise, how they used leaven is kind of the picture that I get. So it's just, again, the idea of haste and urgency to be prepared to leave. Okay? All right. Turn now to Daniel, okay? Chapter 9. We're going to get in some weird stuff here for just a second, and I'll show you why. Okay? Now, just to show you a big picture, Daniel, as you think through just the process of where he's writing, okay? So we're fast-forwarding in history a little bit. I want to set the context, okay? So as we're talking about where we're at, Exodus obviously is here. Daniel is down here, okay? He writes after the captivity of Israel, okay? So if you think through it, Daniel is like the very end of our Old Testament, okay? Israel has already gotten kicked out of the land, so all the kings have come and gone. So David's dead, Saul, Solomon, the 39 kings that reigned over the north and the south after the kingdom divides underneath Solomon, they're gone, and Daniel now is in Babylon. He got kicked out of the land just like every other Jew, and that's where they're at, okay? So I want you guys just to think through big picture history. We're fast forwarding hundreds of years is what we're about to read, but it's going to tie back into this idea of Passover a little bit, okay? So chapter 9, verse 20, Daniel's been in Babylon. He's praying. He's seeking God. 9:20 says, "Now while I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God in behalf of the holy mountain, while I was speaking," in verse 21, "then the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in a vision previously, came to me in extreme weariness about the time of the evening offering." Okay, who is Gabriel? He's an angel, right? The archangel, okay? So Daniel's praying and fasting, and he's confessing the sins of Israel, which got them into bondage to begin with and got them thrown out of the land. So he's talking about them disobeying, what happens, and we'll read through all this history. But Daniel's confessing. And then Gabriel comes to Daniel while he's praying, while he's weary, and he's going to give them what we're about to read, okay? So, and it's a bit confusing, but we'll work our way through it, okay? He gave me instruction in verse 22, talked with me, said, "Oh, Daniel, I've come forth to give you insight and understanding," okay? Verse 23, "At the beginning of your supplications, the command was issued, and I have come to tell you that you are highly esteemed, so give heed to the message and gain understanding of it," okay? So he's about to give Daniel a vision, and it's crazy, okay? 24, I want someone to pick up there, and we'll kind of work through this slowly.
70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city to finish the transcript.
Okay, stop right there, okay? Actually, you know what? We'll keep reading. I'm sorry, I'm not going to cut you off. Read through 25.
Right.
Start over, because I was so rude to interrupt you.
No worries. 70 weeks are determined for you, or for your people and for your holy city, to finish the transgressions, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy.
Okay, pause there for just a second. Okay, so Daniel says 70 weeks have been decreed for your people, okay, the Jews, okay? And you see in that verse 24, six things that are mentioned, okay? Finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, make atonement for iniquity, all these things, okay? So he's saying this is what's going to occur at the finality of this 70-week thing that he's talking about, okay? Keep going to 25.
Now therefore, and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, that there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublesome times.
All right, so he says, now remember, what's the condition of the temple that we haven't even studied yet, but after they got kicked out of Israel, what happened to the temple? It's destroyed, okay? So he says, you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, this is God's city, and to restore until Messiah the Prince, the idea is you're going to be allowed at the issuing of a decree to go back home, your people will, to rebuild Jerusalem, the city, the wall, and the temple from that decree until Messiah the Prince, okay? In verse 25, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It's going to be built with moat and plaza, and even in times of distress, the idea that it's going to be finished to completion. Okay, so let's just talk about this for a second. We're talking about weeks and numbers, so I just want to pause and get an idea of why we're talking about this, and then hopefully you guys are going to connect this to Passover and why the heck we're talking about end time stuff and this kind of thing. Okay, so 70 weeks in verse 24 have been decreed for your people. Okay. Who's got an NIV? I've scared you all and no one will carry an NIV anymore. Read yours. Verse 24, sorry.
Sevens.
That's literally the word, okay? It's one of the few instances that NIV actually gets it right, okay? It's 70 sevens, okay? What in our unit of time as readers do we understand our sevens? What unit of time do we make? Weeks, right? So that's why NASB, ESV, they make the translation weeks, okay? We don't think in periods of seven, okay? We think in periods of tens in our system, right? You guys remember studying with Rick and the sixes and that sort of thing? Sevens would have been significant in Israel, and this is why Daniel is being spoken to in this language, okay? What happens every 7 years in Israel with the harvesting process? What do they have to do? They had to stop, right? They took a year off. That was your rest for the land. So you would, and we'll talk about this in Leviticus, you would take the seventh year off. You didn't plow, you didn't sow, you didn't do anything. And you ate the grain that was provided on the sixth year. God said, I'll promise to give you enough for the sixth and enough for the seventh and enough, obviously, for the eighth year while you're sowing and yet haven't reaped a harvest. So this idea of sevens was common for them. We think in decades. So what if I said to you, to give you an idea of what we're talking about, 70 tens, right? That would have been, if our language. If I said to you, we're going to have 70 10-year periods, how long is that total? 700, right? You just do the math, right? That would have been 700 years, okay? So if we're talking about 70 sevens, this is units of 7 years, what is that?
490.
490, right? We're just doing math. You guys all with me? I'm terrible at math, and I can figure this out, okay?
I have a question.
Yep.
Are they taking, like, the eighth year off or the seventh year?
The seventh year in their history. But the eighth year, you haven't even sown in the land yet, so you've got to wait that entire year to get a crop. So the crop of the sixth year has to provide for the sixth. The whole seventh while you're taking a break. And until the crop comes in on the eighth year, it's got to provide for that season as well. So 6 months.
So would the seventh actually be 8 years?
No. I'm just painting you a picture of the sevens. This is different, okay? I'm just giving you an idea of why God is speaking to Daniel in seven, okay? So basically, 70 weeks have been decreed for your people. 490 years have been decreed for your people. 70 sevens, okay, you with me? For your people that are the Jews, and for your city, your holy city, what is that? What's their holy city? Jerusalem, okay, to finish the transgression, and then you see this list of things that are mentioned here, okay? 1 through 3, the first three things, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, have to deal with sin. So what Daniel's being told is both for him and his people, and it's yet future. And we're going to find out some of the stuff that's being told to him by Gabriel isn't just like now, it's even past where we are. It's prophetic. So what he's hearing, some of the stuff hasn't occurred yet. To bring everlasting righteousness in verse 24, or is it 25? 24, to seal up a vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy place. Everlasting righteousness has not occurred yet. So some of these things are even post, this is the second return of Christ. Okay, so I'm just, this is a big nugget that we're kind of trying to attack, okay? So we've got a 490-year period that's going to begin when? What is Daniel saying, or what is Gabriel saying? During the exile, yeah, but there's going to be what? Like, we know it's a 490-year period, but what's going to start the clock, according to verse 25? A decree, okay? So you will know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, that's going to start the clock until you see what? Messiah the Prince. That's going to be 490 years, okay? There will be 7 weeks, okay, or 40, we'll do the math here in a second, okay? It will be built again with plaza and moat and distress. So there's a timeline that's going to start with the issuing of a decree. Now, do we have in Scripture the recording of an issuing of a decree to go restore and rebuild Jerusalem? Yes, we have several, okay? There are a number mentioned, and I won't bore you with all the details. There's four under different kings. One was Cyrus, one was Darius, one was Artaxerxes, and then in Nehemiah chapter 2, Artaxerxes issues a decree, okay, allows the people to go home. That was in 444 BC, and everything that is mentioned here in Daniel as to what would be happened, all the things that they were allowed to do, was fulfilled in this decree, okay, and we happen to know the exact date of that decree, okay. It was on, sorry, this is where I can use my notes because I got so much stuff going on. Friday, I really want to like you guys. Thursday's got you beat. We just need a folder. All right, so we've got this decree. How do you spell decree? Two E's at the end?
Yep.
Yeah. Something like that. What did my notes say? It was issued on Nisan. Okay, I'll give you both Hebrew and our dates. Oops, sorry, Nisan the first, 444 BC. Okay? That's when the decree from Artaxerxes was issued, okay? That is March the 5th, my kid's birthday, 444 BC. Okay? So there's Hebrew, there's our timetable. Okay?
One S in Nisan or two?
Just one. Oh. It's not like the car. Does the car have two?
Yeah. Yeah.
Not like the car. Okay? So the start date of the issuing of this decree, that's our date. Okay? We know it from history. That is the date. Okay? Now, in verse 25, it gets kind of weirdo, but you are to know from the issuing of that decree, okay, to Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. Okay? 69 weeks. We're going to combine those, and that's what the text seems to allude to. We've got 7 weeks, which is 77s or years, 49 years, and that's the exact time it took Nehemiah to build the wall, okay? Now, so if you take, and I'll show you guys this. Can you see that? No, you can't. Why are you up there so high? There, okay? So this is the math that we're going to do. Well, that's much better. Can you guys even read that like 3 rows back? Sorry, I had to copy and paste that out of my notes. We're going to take this whole timetable, this 69 weeks. If you look at the Jewish side of it, you take 7 weeks plus the 62 weeks, which is what is mentioned in verse 25. That's 69 weeks total, okay, from the issuing of a decree moving forward. 69 weeks, which is 7 years of weeks, is 483 years, okay? So we were dealing with the 490 years, but we're talking about 69 weeks, not all 70, okay? So there's something going on with this picture. So in 69 weeks, according to this Jewish calendar, is 365 days a year, or 360 days rather in the Jewish calendar. That's how many days they had in their year, is 173,880 days. Okay, so I'm just doing some math for you. Okay, You want to do it the other way in our calendar because we have 365 days a year. We end up with the same math, however you want to look at it, okay? So this whole period of time from the issuing of decree until Messiah the Prince is 173,880 days, okay? So at the end of this period that starts with the rebuilding of the decree, something regarding the Mashiach Nagi, Messiah the Prince, should, that's the end of it, okay? So either way you want to do the math, that's the picture, okay? Does that make sense? Kinda, okay? Decree's issued. This is how long we got. I know it's confusing. It's a lot of stuff, but I'll show you guys why this is significant, okay? Now, if you take 173,880 days from here, that is March 30th, 33 AD, or Nisan the 10th, 33 AD. Anybody know what happened on Nisan 10, which is, by the way, what day? No, we just read it in... What's the significance of Nisan the 10th? Lamb Selection Day. Does anybody happen to know what happened on Lamb Selection Day, Nisan 10, 33 AD? Not Good Friday. Close. Back it up 5 days. Jesus walked into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday on the back of a horse saying what? I'm the Lamb. On Lamb Selection Day to the day as prophesied in the book of Daniel. This is the day where Jesus walks in during the triumphal entry in Luke chapter 22 and says, I am the Lamb. Now, we don't get this kind of clarity and coolness in a lot of parts of the Bible, but that to me is fascinating. That we know the date of a decree to the day, March 5th, 44 BC. We are given exact number of days as to how long that's going to be. And on that day, 462 years later, Jesus walks into Jerusalem declaring himself as the Lamb that will take away the sins of the world. Are your minds blown a little bit? Give me something. Okay, it's Friday. That to me is amazing. Okay, and obviously then he's going to go to the cross. He's going to celebrate Passover with his disciples that Thursday, saying that I'm the Lamb. He's going to go to the cross on Friday, and he's going to be raised from the dead that following Sunday. So it's crazy as you kind of look through the significance of how that works, right? So there's lots going on in Daniel, but that's what I want to point you guys back to. This would have involved the final Passion Week of Jesus. That would have been Lamb Selection Day. So Jesus was chosen, if you will, on Lamb Selection Day. He died on Nisan the 14th. That was Good Friday in that context. And that day, on the day the Passover lamb was killed, that's when Jesus died on the cross. He was buried during unleavened bread and rose during first fruits. He is a Jewish Messiah, okay? And the Jews should have been, if they were doing the math correctly, looking for something regarding the Mashiach Nagiv on Nisan 10, 33 AD. And who shows up? Jesus. And says, I'm that guy that Daniel prophesied about 462 years plus ago that I would be here. That's insane, y'all. Okay, that is absolutely mind-boggling to me that God would give us that. All right, so tuck that away. Enjoy it. I know the math's a little bit crazy, so hopefully you guys can kind of understand. You're not going to disconnect. Come on. That ain't right.
Can you put that paper on a Dropbox?
Yes. I can. For a fee. Yes, absolutely. What's going on here?
It was struggling yesterday at lunch, too.
Yeah, I will put that on Dropbox. More better? Yeah, I'll throw that in there. Yeah, I'll tell you. Yeah. There you go. Okay. So we won't go there necessarily, but in Luke chapter 22, this is when they would have celebrated the Passover with Christ, and that's literally the piece that they're talking about. Jesus would have been working through the cups of wine. I mentioned this yesterday. He talks about, as he's more than likely talking about the role that he's going to play, talking about that third promise, using the third cup to talk about the redemption that he was going to bring as part of the Lord's Supper. Cup four he never got to, because that's the ultimate one that he's going to take the people to be his, and they will be their God. That's still ultimately yet future. But just wanted you guys to see the picture of what God's doing in the midst of this and how fascinating that is, that God would give us that type of timeline and that type of detail. Okay, so let's pause there for a second, and you guys can maybe wrap your minds around that a little bit. Does that make sense? Kinda? Más o menos.
I'm a little confused on where, because I know the sevens, and so week sevens, I get that. But with the 69, exactly where those numbers for the math came from, maybe I like misheard or something, but that didn't make sense to me.
In 25, you will know and discern from the issuing of a decree to rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. So the question is, what do you do with those? What do you do with 7 weeks and 62 weeks? Why did they get broken up that way? I have no idea. It seems like they're to be added together.
Okay.
I don't know why he just didn't say 69 weeks, but it's prophetic, and I'm not going to argue with Michael the Archangel, okay, or Gabriel. So that's where the 69 comes from, okay? The 70th week of Daniel, by the way, has not happened yet, okay? As we look at our timeline in our history in terms of what the well believes in a pre-trib, pre-mill, rapture, and end-time scheme, that last week, that last 7 years is what? It's the tribulation. That's what we believe is going to happen after Messiah comes to rescue us, to rapture us, and then it says literally there will be a seven-year period on earth where the last week of Daniel is fulfilled. So at some point during the 70-year prophetic time, the clock was stopped. And it stopped when Jesus died on the cross. So for whatever reason, that 70th week of Daniel is yet to be fulfilled. And God's going to start the clock again when the Messiah comes out of the clouds and rescues us. Okay. Now, depending on your theology and where you line up with the rapture and the second coming and how those events work for you, that is the theology of the well. We stand on kind of a pre-mill, pre-trib rapture, which means we believe that believers are going to be rescued, that will be lifted up before the tribulation, that we as believers won't go through that 70th week of Daniel, that literally hell on earth. You can read in Revelation about it, and you guys maybe even studying it in here. That's kind of where we land, and then there ultimately will be fulfilled after that seven-year period, a thousand-year kingdom on earth that's described in Revelation 20. You know, I'll move from there. So, yeah, Eric. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know. That's a good question. But we see Messiah mentioned, so it's pretty clear who they're waiting for, right? Messiah the Prince. Okay? So, make sense? Daniel's some of the craziest stuff to wrestle with, by the way. So, I used to paint in college, and I would listen to David Jeremiah. You guys know who he is? Pastor down south. I was painting apartments, and I remember him walking through this. I'm painting, trying to pay attention to what I'm doing, and listening to this prophetic stuff, and I'm like, oh, my brain hurts. So, anyway.
My question, I have a question on 360 days a year.
Okay.
Wouldn't in the Jewish calendar they would add extra leap months in?
They would. So they would add, yes, they would add every so often. So, I forget what it is, but yes.
So, it wouldn't be a constant 360 days a year, or is that on average?
If that's their average, and it's based on the lunar cycle and then the harvest. So, yeah, but the math is still the same.
Okay.
Those are not necessarily included there, but. Yeah.
Okay.
But yes, you're correct. Moving forward, they do that. Cool. All right. Back to Exodus, shall we? So, that's the type of stuff, gang, just for me, that affirms what we believe and the fact that you go, man, that's insane. That God could call a shot like Babe Ruth to the day and say, that is what's going to happen. So. We do. We say there's another week coming. It's 1 week, right? Which is 7 years. So we do.
Does that mean we can calculate to the day when Jesus is coming?
The problem is we don't know when it's going to start. We know it's when it starts, we know that it will be 7 years, but we don't know what's going to start that. So it's him returning, and nobody knows when his return is going to be. So that's a great question. We just don't know when God's going to restart the clock. So we're in this parentheses that's called the church age, right? You guys talked about that in Acts a little bit in Matthew. We just don't know how long that parentheses is going to last, right? So in the grand scheme of things, the end times is about Israel, right? And it's as if you're looking at two mountains like this, and one's in the background. Sorry, that's terrible. But you get the idea. That's god awful. That's what I confess. I'm I'm sorry. Right? In the distance, they look like there's maybe no space, and then you can see them like this later where you realize there's this huge gap. Well, so far, this gap's been 2,000 years, right? But we just don't know how much longer that's going to last. But in the grand scheme of things, we are we're a blip on the radar for what God's ultimately trying to do with Israel. We just don't know how long that's going to be. But to your point, yeah, absolutely, we're going to take that literally. We just don't know when God wants to start it. Okay? Good question. Yep.
So just to clarify this, when they're saying sevens, it's years, not weeks?
Yeah, weeks of years, basically. So 7 years is that period. Each week is 7 years. So 70 weeks is 70 times 7, right? So each 7 is 7 years. Each week is 7 years. By the way, I didn't walk you guys through it when we did this originally. When we talked about Jacob in Padan Aram, and he was marrying Rachel and Leah, and we had that whole debacle about, oops, I slept with the wrong wife. You guys remember that? And Laban says to him, turn there real quick. Genesis 29. This is another interpretation of this. So in case you're wondering, like, do we have any evidence in our Bible that would demonstrate that maybe weeks mean 7 years? Maybe, okay? I don't know. It seems like the interpretation that I gave you originally, in terms of week being a bridal week, literally a physical week, this is the same word week that's used in Daniel that we just read. 77s, this is the word sevens, okay? Laban says in verse 26, it's not our practice to marry off our younger daughter before the firstborn. 29:27, complete the week for this one, and we will give you the other also of the service which you shall serve with me for another how long? 7 years. So is Laban saying, look, you served me a week, 7 years for what you thought was Rachel, but oops, I gave you Leah. Serve another week for this one, i.e. another 7 years, and I'll give you Rachel. How long was Jacob there? 7, 7, and 6. He stayed 20 years with Laban. And that could be, I kind of, depending on how I get out of bed, I lean that direction as well. It makes contextually a ton of sense. You're here 7 years. Great. Your payment is paid. You're going to get my second born, which you thought was my first. Stay another 7 years, and you'll get the one you loved. Right? Or it could just be, hey, complete the week, and then I'll give you her, and you're going to have two wives and basically have a double wedding. I'm not sure, but the word's the same, and in the same verse, complete the week, which is another 7 years. It's like, gosh, that seems to make sense in context to me as well, okay? So in case you guys are looking for evidence that a week does in fact mean 7 years, there you go, okay? I've heard different stuff on that as well, and I'm not studied on it, but man, it seems pretty clear when Jesus says to the disciples in Acts 1, nobody knows the time set by the Father, that's for the Father alone. Even Jesus says, I have chosen to limit my knowledge on that, and we don't know. So,
and does it say, because I know in one place it says, no one knows the day or the hour. I think there's another place that says, no one knows the season, right?
Yeah, I forget. Shay was talking about a prophetic guy. It may have been from the pulpit when we were studying this. Yeah, it was when he was talking about Matthew 24. But there was a guy that said, well, we don't know the day or the hour, but we can know the year or whatever it is. And then he tried to prophesy 88 reasons why Christ was going to come in 1988 or whatever. Anyway, I don't know if you guys remember that sermon, but yeah. I stay away from that stuff just because when God says you don't know, I go, okay, I don't. You don't either, so great. I'm dumb, so like my simple mind, I'm totally fine with that. But y'all can go study that, okay? All right, so back to Genesis. Let's pick up here a little bit. Exodus, rather. We're done with Genesis. Done with you. So.
Real quick.
Yep.
What verses was it in Luke
22? Luke 22, starting in 7 and 8, we see the disciples preparing the upper room. In 14 and following, they are at the upper room celebrating the Last Supper, okay, where Jesus walks through all the imagery that is the Passover. So there's something cool about remembering. Our idea of communion was simply Jesus celebrating Passover with his disciples. That's what they were doing. They were being obedient Jews celebrating an event that had occurred thousands of years in their rearview window and still faithfully doing it. And Jesus says, these symbols are bigger than just God being, you know, delivering his people out of Egypt. This is me. I am the bread. I am the wine. I am the picture of what all this is. So anyway, for what it's worth, okay? So let's pick up in chapter 12, verse 37. They have been given freedom now to go. Israel's leaving Egypt. And I want you to notice a couple things in the unfolding of this text. We'll mention a couple verses and stop at the end of verse 12 today, okay? 12:37.
And the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, besides children.
All right, now let's pause there for a second. So how many people did we come in? Dave mentioned this yesterday when they went into Israel, Jacob and his family. 70, like 66 plus some grand chitlins. We had 70 people that were Hebrew entering the land. How many are we leaving with?
600,000 men.
600,000 dudes. The word in Hebrew is dudes, okay? It's males, okay? So let's just say we're going to double that for females, okay? So we've got now 1.2 million females. 1.2 million. You never told you guys that story? The Molly and Faye Molly story? Oh, gosh, this is epic. Sorry. Squirrel. I worked in the ER for a while. I was pre-med starting school, and I was talking to the nurses one day as we were in there. I was just like little peon that cleaned stuff and what have you, but I was learning a ton of stuff from these nurses because I thought I wanted to be a doctor until I realized school's hard and I don't want to do that. Anyway, they had a gal that came in the OB delivery room and I guess came through the ER, and they were asking her ultimately after she had had twins what she wanted their names to be, and she had read on a sign somewhere the names Male and Faye Male, and thought those are beautiful. So she had a boy and a girl and named them Male and Faye Male. Male and female. So anyway, but that's funny. So every time I see those words, I can't help but laugh. So
did they correspond to the right gender?
I think they did, as I recall. Yeah, I hope. Wow, can you imagine being named Faye Male and you're a boy? Yeah. So there's a kid in my class that I work with at Susan B. whose name is Diane. He's a guy, and I'm like, dude, my name's Shannon. I totally feel for you, buddy. I'm like, I'm going to laugh at your name, but I can laugh at your name. So I had a lady on the phone the other week literally laugh out loud. Shannon there. This is he. She's like, she kind of like locked up her hard drive. She's like, I thought I was going to speak with your wife. I'm like, no, I'm Shannon. She's like, I'm sorry. <It's> okay. Like, I'm a dude. I'm okay with it, right? Anyway, so 600,000 guys. You add maybe the equality of that, right? You got 1.2 million adults plus kids. How many people are we talking about? We're at minimum 1.2 million, maybe upwards of 3 million people that are leaving Israel. Can you fathom that? That's insane. 400 years ago, we had 66, 70 guys that are, or men and women that are entering the land. Has God been faithful to bless them in difficulty? Absolutely. Okay, so remember that number. 1.2 to 3 million. You're going to want to know that later, like in June. Okay? All right. How do they leave? Verse 38. Watch who else comes.
A mixed multitude went up with them also, and flocks and herds, a great deal of livestock. And then.
All right. Just pause right there. A mixed multitude. What does that mean?
Didn't some of the Egyptians go with them?
Yeah. So why would Egyptians go with them? Literally, like, this sucks. Like, our land's gone. So a number of reasons. Either they got nothing to stay home for, or they're like, you know what? Your God's the real deal. We have seen the magic show, and we're in. Like, this God is, he's done it all, right? He's been locusts and plagues, and this is amazing. So we're in. This looks like a party. So we're going to see more of the mixed multitude in a bit. So just remember that. There are non-Hebrews that are on this journey. Okay, some of their intentions are legit, and they have full-on worship God, bow their knee to Yahweh, and there are others that are just kind of along for the show, right? They've seen David Blaine or whatever his name is, the magician, right? And they think God's super cool, and they're in it for, you know, the vending machine God, if you will, right? Keep going to 39.
And they baked 11 cakes of the dough which they had brought out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, because they were driven out of Egypt and could not wait, nor had they prepared provisions for themselves. Now the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years.
So that is the exact amount of time, 430 years. Genesis tells us they're going to be in a land that was not theirs. God tells Abraham how long? You guys remember that? Genesis 15, maybe? 400 years. So he rounds it off, okay? Genesis 15, 13. Tell me if this isn't crazy. God said to Abram, "Know for certain your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. That's Genesis chapter 15, y'all. To Abraham, God calls a shot. So, I mean, if you're wondering if God knows what's going on, just a little bit, okay? He can predict the future because he knows the future. So 430 years is the exact number. Came about the end of 430 years, verse 41, to the very day that all the host of Israel went out of the land of Egypt. It is that night. It is that night to be observed for the Lord for having brought them out of the land of Egypt. This night is for the Lord to be observed by all the sons of Israel throughout their generations. Okay, 43, pick up there.
And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, this is the ordain of the Passover for the no foreigner shall eat it.
Okay, so if you're not a Hebrew, you can't eat of it unless, 44.
But every man's servant who is brought who's bought for money, when you have circumcised him, then he may eat it.
Okay, so again, why was this such a big deal for Moses that God almost killed him on the road? To identify yourself to being Hebrew was to be circumcised, to identify yourself with the promises of God. If you've done that, whether you're a slave purchased with money, whether you're an import from, you know, Egypt that says, hey, I'm in, great, no problem. Be circumcised and you're in. Okay, a sojourner or a hired servant shall not eat it. So if you're not identifying yourself with the covenant of God, this isn't for you. Okay. In 44 and following, again, you see more, it shall be eaten in every single house. You're to bring forth any of the flesh and meat outside. No leftovers. We see all that recommended or commanded rather again. And God's kind of rule with that, right? So we'll end there in chapter 12. We'll pick up in 13 next week as we now see the people leaving the land, leaving Egypt, and now Pharaoh's second thoughts and so forth is you guys know how this is going to work and God's commands as they leave, all right? So rock on. I will, I'll throw this stuff in Dropbox for you guys later today and so you can get an idea of some of the math and such yourself. And we'll go from there, all right? So you guys enjoy your weekend, be safe, and we'll see you next Thursday.
From like the 90s.
Well, I mean, my kids loved it, so I watched a lot of it.
Oh, I'm gonna watch it today. I'm sure it'll be great.
Do it.